Chapter 4. So here she was, in the bleak small hours of the morning, strapped tightly into the confined cockpit of a hyperglider that was tethered to the barren rock floor of Stakeout Canyon, waiting for the storm to arrive with its 200 kilometers per hour winds. At her age, and with her family heritage behind her, there were probably a great many better things for Justine Bernelli to be doing. Most of the ones she could think of right now involved beds with silk sheets, preferably shared with a man, or spa baths, or extremely expensive restaurants, or plush nightclubs. But the only luxuries within about 1,000 kilometers were currently racing away from her as fast as the support crews could drive the convoy's mobile homes over this god-awful terrain. And it was all thanks to her newest best friend, Estella Fenton. They'd met in the day lounge of the exclusive Washington Rejuvenation Clinic she always used, both of them just out of the tank and undergoing physiotherapy, hydrotherapy, massage, and herbal aromatherapy, among other remedies to bring some life back to limbs and muscles that hadn't been used for 14 months. They moved like old-time geriatrics, an irony made worse by their apparently adolescent bodies. All anyone did in the lounge was sit in the deep, gel-cushioned chairs and stare out at the wooded parkland beyond the picture windows. A hardy few used handheld arrays to do some work, reading the screens and talking to the programs. None of them had retained the ability to interface directly with the cybersphere. Their bodies had all been purged of most of their inserts, like processors and ock tattoos, during the rejuvenation process, and they hadn't received their new ones yet. Estella had been led into the airy lounge by two nurses, one holding each arm as the gorgeous young redhead wobbled unsteadily between them. She sank into the chair with a grateful sigh. "We'll be back for your hydro session at 3 o'clock," the senior nurse said. "Thank you so much," Estella said with a forced smile. It blanked out as soon as the nurses left the lounge. "Bloody hell."
"Just out?" Justine asked.
2 days.
3, myself.
God, another 10 days of this.
Worth it, though.
Justine held up the paper screen she'd been reading. It was still running through the articles and pictures of the fashion magazine she'd accessed.
I haven't been able to wear anything this good for the last 10 years.
Although plenty of her female friends underwent rejuvenation religiously every 20 years, or less, Justine tended to wait until her body age was around 50 before going through the whole process again. You could carry vanity too far.
"I'm not even at the stage where I'm thinking of clothes yet," Estella said. She ran a hand through her disheveled hair, which was an all-over bonnet 5 centimeters long. "I need to get styled first, and I hate having hair this short. I normally wear it down to my waist, and that always takes a couple of years to grow," she grouched.
"That must look lovely."
"I don't have any trouble catching men."
She glanced around the lounge.
"God, I don't even feel like that right now."
The clinic was strictly single-sex, although that didn't always stop clients who were nearing the end of their physical therapy period from indulging in a bit of illicit hanky-panky in their rooms. It wasn't just youth's appearance they reclaimed after rejuve. Their newly adolescent bodies were flush with hormones and vitality. Sex was at the top of just about everybody's agenda when they left a rejuvenation clinic and tended to stay there for quite a while. Justine grinned.
"Won't be long.
You'll be heading for the nearest silent world full speed ahead."
"Been there, done that 100 times over. Not to say that I won't make a stop-off on the way, but I've got something more exhilarating planned for this time."
"Oh, what's that?" That had turned out to be a 2-month-long safari across far away. Justine had almost outright rejected the notion of joining her. But the more Estella talked about it, and she talked about very little else, the more it began to lodge in her mind. After all, far away was the only true wild world within the Commonwealth, where civilization's grip on the inhabitants was a loose one. It was difficult and expensive to reach. The climate and environment were odd. The enigmatic alien ship Marie Celeste was still there, puzzling researchers as much as it had on the day of its discovery. And then there was the ultimate geological challenge, the Grand Triad,
the three largest volcanoes in the known galaxy, arranged in a tight triangle. Justine's hyperglider was tethered just inside the wide opening of Stakeout Canyon, so the nose was pointing east, which put Mount Zeus to her left. In the daytime, when the ground crew was rigging the hyperglider, all she could see of that colossus was its rocky lower slope, which formed one side of the huge, funnel-shaped canyon. The crater peak could never be seen from the base. It was 17 kilometers high. To her right was Mount Titan, the only currently active volcano of the three, its crater rim standing outside the atmosphere at 23 kilometers high. Sometimes at night, and if the eruption was particularly violent, the rose-gold corona shimmering above the glowing lava could be seen from the Pampas lands away to the south, as if a red dwarf had just set behind the horizon. Directly ahead of her, forming the impossibly blunt and massive end of the canyon, was Mount Herculaneum. Measuring 711 kilometers wide across its base, the volcano was roughly conical, with its twin caldera summit leveling out at 32 kilometers above sea level, putting it a long way above Faraway's troposphere. Thankfully, the geologists had classed it as semi-active. It had never erupted in the 180-odd years since human settlement had begun, though it had produced a few spectacular shudders in that time. That volcanism could produce such huge features on a small planet like Faraway was a wonderful enigma to her. Of course, she'd studied articles on the science of it all. The fact that only a 40% standard gravity allowed something as gigantic as Mount Herculaneum to exist, while on a world with normal Earth-like gravity it would collapse under its own weight. And the lack of tectonic plates meant that lava simply continued to pile up in the same spot, eon after eon. But none of that cool reasoning could detract from the actuality of the monstrous landscape she'd come to experience. The power and forces amassing around her were elemental, a planet's strength readily visible as nowhere else. And she was sitting in her pathetic little machine, in a lunatic attempt to tame that power, to make it do her bidding. Her hands were shaking slightly inside her flight suit as the first hint of dawn emerged, with an outline of slate-gray sky materializing high above the end of the canyon. She cursed Estella Bloody Fenton for the sight. It didn't help calm her nerves, knowing that Estella was in a similar hyperglider fastened to the rock a couple of kilometers away, staring out at the same inhospitable jags of rock. "It's starting," someone said over the radio. There was no cybersphere on Faraway. In fact, no modern communications at all outside Armstrong City and the larger towns. 100 years earlier, there had been a few satellites providing some coverage for the countryside and ocean, but the Guardians of Selfhood had shot down the last of them long ago. All anybody had out here was simple radio, and Faraway's turbulent ionosphere didn't offer a lot of assistance to that. "There's some movement out here. Wind's picking up." Justine peered through the tough, transparent hood of the cockpit. Nothing moved on the bare rock below her. The storms that swept in from the Hondu Ocean to the west were channeled and squeezed by Zeus and Titan to roar along this one canyon between them. It had been scoured clean of any loose soil or pebbles, geological ages ago. "Derek," Justine called, "can you hear me?" Her only answer was a fluctuating buzz of static as the dawn slowly poured a wan light down into the canyon. "Derek?" The caravan of trucks, 4x4s, and mobile homes must be clear now, she acknowledged grimly, over Zeus's foothills and sheltered in some deep gully from the morning storm. All the mad hyperglider pilots were on their own now. No escape. Somehow this part of it had been missed off the slick advertising and intensive reassuring briefing sessions. Even the pilot skill training memory implementation hadn't included it. Waiting helplessly, as the wind from the ocean built from a gentle breeze to a deranged hurricane. Waiting, unable to do anything. Waiting, watching, waiting and worrying. Waiting as fright emerged from some primal place deep in the brain, growing and growing. "How's it going, darling?" Estella asked. "Fine, you bitch. Actually, I'm getting a bit nervous."
"Nervous? Lucky cow. I'm scared shitless."
Justine instructed her e-butler to run through the cockpit procedures again, checking the hyperglider's systems. Even with the limited capacity of the onboard array, the e-butler produced a perfect control interface. Its review was instantaneous, translucent icons blinked up inside her virtual vision, everything was online and fully functional. "Remind me again why I want to do this."
"Because it beats the hell out of breakfast in bed," Estella told her.
"In a 5-star hotel.
On a Caribbean island with a veranda overlooking the beach, where dolphins are playing in the water."
It was getting a lot lighter outside. Justine could finally see some thin streamers of sand drifting past the hyperglider. They must have blown in from the coast, she thought. She switched the weather radar to the main console screen, studying the blobs of vivid color as they surged and squabbled against each other. The storm was definitely on its way. Scarlet ribbons, representing dense high-velocity air, were seeping across the screen like some kind of fresh wound, always expanding. In a way, she was glad the storm was heading in from the west, creeping up on her from behind. It meant she couldn't watch the hammerhead clouds as they devoured the sky. She was quite frightened enough as it was. Even now, she wasn't sure she was going to make the flight. There was an option to just stay here. The hyperglider was currently configured into a smooth, fat cigar shape, the wing buds confined below the main fuselage. She could simply keep the tethers wound in and let the winds roar around her until it was all over. Many had, so she'd been told, bottling out at the last moment. Right now, in the middle of the annual storm season, it was an average 5-hour wait for the gales to sweep over. Within 20 minutes, the wind was strong enough to start shaking the hyperglider. If there was sand out there, she couldn't see it anymore. Red waves washed continually across the weather radar screen.
"Still there?" Estella asked.
"Still here."
"Won't be long now."
"Yeah. Are you getting the same readings from your radar?" "Some of those airstreams are almost 200 kilometers an hour already."
The digital figures for wind speed were blurring. They were mounting so fast. At this rate, the storm's central powerhouse would be overhead in another 40 to 50 minutes, and those were the winds she wanted. If she took off now, the hyperglider would simply be driven into the base of Mount Herculaneum.
The radio band seemed to be full of bad jokes and nervy bravado. Justine didn't join in with any of it, although listening was a strange kind of comfort. It helped keep away the sense of isolation. Clouds were rampaging across the sky now, gradually becoming lower. They blocked the rising sun, cutting the illumination to a gloomy twilight, although she could still see the swollen tatters of rain charging off into the distance. The rock around the hyperglider began to glisten with a thin sheen of water.
"Wind's reaching 200, Estella called out. There was dread mingling with anticipation in her voice. "I'm about to release. See you on the other side, darling."
"I'll be there," Justine yelled. The fuselage was shaking violently now, producing a steady high-volume thrumming. Even the howl of the wind was penetrating the heavily insulated cockpit. The screen displays on the console in front of her were jumbled, thanks to the quivering, jittering lines of color, completely out of focus. She had to rely almost completely on the more basic information inside her virtual vision. Gray mist was a constant blur outside, eliminating any sight of the sky or canyon walls. Then it was time. The winds along the ground of Stakeout Canyon were over 160 kilometers an hour. Her radar showed the storm's leading edge was now boiling up Mount Herculaneum ahead of her, and that was the critical factor. Those winds had to be there to carry her a long, long way. Without them, this was going to be a short trip with one very abrupt ending. She put her hands down on the console's eye spots, fingers curling around the grip bars. Ply plastic flowed around them, securing them for what promised to be a turbulent flight. The Oc tattoos on her wrists completed the link between the eye spots and her main nerve cords, interfacing her directly with the onboard array. Virtual hands appeared inside her virtual vision. Her customization had given them long, slender fingers with green nails and glowing blue neon rings on every finger. A joystick materialized amid the icons, and she moved her virtual hand to grasp it. Her other hand started tapping icons, initiating one final systems check. With everything coming up green,
she ordered the onboard array to deploy the wings. The pliplastic buds swelled out, elongating to become small, thick delta shapes. The thrumming increased dramatically as they caught the wind. Tethers were being strained close to their tolerance limits. Justine prayed the carbon-reinforced titanium anchor struts, driven 50 meters into the naked rock by the support team, would survive the next few minutes. Some little demon inside said, "Last chance to stay put and live."
Justine moved her virtual hand and flipped the forward tether icon. The locks disengaged, and she was immediately shaken violently from side to side as the hyperglider fishtailed. An instinctive response from the implanted training memory came to her aid. She twisted the joystick, and the wings bent downward several degrees. A touch on the rear tether icon, and the two strands extended. The hyperglider lifted 20 meters into the air, still shaking frantically, as if it was desperate to be rid of its final restraints. Justine halted the tether extension and began to test her control surfaces. The rear of the hyperglider was quickly shifted into a vertical stabilizer fin. Wings expanded a little farther, angling to produce more lift. Finally, once she cleared the ground, the dreadful thrumming vibration faded away, although never cutting out altogether. Now all she had to contend with was the awesome roar of the wind as it accelerated toward 200 kilometers an hour. At this point, the hyperglider was nothing more than a giant kite. Very carefully, she began to extend the rear tethers still farther. They played out behind her, and the hyperglider rose eagerly away from the ground. After 2 minutes of careful extension, she was 100 meters high. The ground wasn't visible, for which she was obscurely thankful. Tatters of mist were scudding past so fast, they prevented her from seeing anything beyond 20 or 30 meters. Raindrops that hit the cockpit transparency immediately hurtled off, scoured clean by the tremendous air velocity. Constantly flexing the wings to compensate for turbulence, she began extending the tethers again. 25 minutes after leaving the ground, she was 1,400 meters high. It was a cautious ascent, but the two tether cables were shaking with a harmonic that set her teeth on edge. Justine configured the pliplastic hyperglider for free flight. The wings flowed outward, reaching 110 meters at full span while curving around into a crescent shape. From above, it made the hyperglider look like a giant scimitar blade, with the cockpit bullet jutting out of the apex. Behind her, the rear fuselage performed a vertical stretch, becoming a deep triangular stabilizer, its tips twitching with near-subliminal motion to keep the craft lined up accurately in the wind stream. She reached 1,500 meters in altitude. The wings curled fractionally along their length, presenting the most efficient lift capture profile to the wind. Looking at the figures on the console screen, she couldn't believe the strain on the tether cables. Almost all the safety margin was used up. Justine sucked down a deep breath as the raw elements screamed around her. If she had the courage, this ought to be the ride of a lifetime. If. She thought back to all those years she'd lived through. From this strange viewpoint, they all seemed so achingly identical and boring. A virtual finger reached forward, almost reluctantly touching the disengage icon. The G-force slammed her back into the seat as the hyperglider cut free, bringing back the weight she hadn't felt since she arrived on Far Away. The craft hurtled toward the blunt end of Stakeout Canyon at 200 kilometers an hour. Immediately it lurched starboard and began to descend. She twisted the joystick to compensate. Not fast, smooth and positive, shifting the wings to alter the airflow. The response was astonishingly quick, sending her swooping upward. Then a near spin started, and she flipped the stabilizer tips to counter it. Every moment demanded her total concentration merely to hold the hyperglider roughly level. It wasn't just the featureless wrap of cloud that cut her off from the outside world. Her attention was focused solely on the attitude display and the radar. As Stakeout Canyon narrowed, she had to hold her course directly down the center. All the time the rock walls closed in toward each other, growing steeper in the process, the furious buffeting increased proportionally. Wild turbulence was constantly trying to swirl the craft around into a spin or pull it down to oblivion. She wasn't even aware of time passing, only the frantic, exhausting fight to keep the hyperglider on track,
If she let it ascend too high, the massive upper wind streams would carry it away over the sides of the canyon as they gushed up and away, expanding in release from the escalating pressure at the base of the walls. She would wind up somewhere on the weather-blasted and boulder-strewn mid-slopes of Zeus, or Titan, hundreds of kilometers from the recovery vehicles of the caravan. Without any warning, the radar picked up the end of the canyon, 25 kilometers away. At this point, where the three volcanoes intersected, Mount Herculaneum was a simple vertical cliff, 6 kilometers high. Her own altitude was 3.5 kilometers. Outside, the wind speed was still increasing within the constriction. The weather radar screen flared lurid scarlet around the edges as it tracked the lethal currents and shockwaves reverberating off the rock. Darkness deepened around her as the shredded clouds were crushed back together. Justine retracted the wings slightly, sacrificing the propulsive push they generated for a little more maneuverability. It had begun to rain steadily outside the cockpit now, thick droplets slashing along beside her. Paradoxically, visibility began to lift. The clouds were recondensing under the pressure. Droplets began to merge together for an instant before the raging winds tore them apart. Then they would reform, a second later, larger this time as the pressure continued to build relentlessly. Semi-cohesive horizontal streams of water churned and foamed around the hyperglider fuselage. The cliff was 12 kilometers away, and she was down to 3 kilometers from the canyon floor. Water had become so dense, it was as if the hyperglider was surfing along inside the crest of some crazy airborne wave. The sun had risen above the volcano slopes, shining down into the top of the canyon. Suddenly, it struck the chaotic foam whipping around the hyperglider, and the world flared into 1,000 tattered sparkling rainbows, birthing and dying, clashing and colliding. Justine laughed in dazed appreciation at the astounding sight. 3 kilometers ahead of her, the gushing rivulets merged into a single writhing torrent 2 kilometers above the floor of Stakeout Canyon. That was a couple of kilometers from the cliff. The rocky constriction was at its narrowest, the pressure at its highest. There was only one way the churning river could escape. Justine slid the hyperglider above the water, staring down on it in utter disbelief. The rainbows fizzled out abruptly. Rock slammed up into her vision to replace them, terrifyingly huge walls of it, stretching up halfway to heaven. Right in front of her, the flying river curved upward and began the long, impossible power climb to freedom as the entire storm went vertical. Blasting out an eternal thunderclap, the wind reached 300 kilometers an hour. She knew she was yelling wordlessly, but couldn't hear herself above the cacophony bombarding the cockpit. The hyperglider was wrenched upward. G-force slammed Justine down into the seat again. Her knuckles grew white as she clenched the grip bars, fearful she'd lose contact with the eye spots. She wrestled the wing surfaces to obey in a desperate bid to maintain stability within the geysering air. Water rose with her, defying gravity to shoot up parallel to the cliff. Even with the hyperglider demanding her full devotion simply to survive the demented air currents, she spared the time, a couple of precious seconds, to stare at the incredible phenomenon. A waterfall going straight up. At 5 kilometers altitude, the foaming sheet of water began to break apart again. The immense upright storm was beginning to spread wide as it reached the top of the canyon. Pressure and wind velocity were weakening. Throughout it all, Justine steered the hyperglider directly up the central track. Water and cloud cascaded away on either side as she burst out above the rock, two immense waves of vapor falling back down in swan-wing curves to crash onto the volcano's lower slopes. Only in the center of the maelstrom did the wind keep howling, thrusting her forward and upward. Mount Herculaneum's gigantic bulk became visible below her, a desolate ground of shattered stone and saturated gravel extending for tens of kilometers around the top of the canyon. Gradually the harshness began to give way to the more welcome stains of ochre and avocado green as the plants reasserted themselves. Tiny grasses rooted hard in crinkled fissures. Hardy tropical moss welded to boulders. The storm continued to rage above them, seeking its escape to the quieter skies in the east, by sliding around the slopes to the north and the south. Justine modified the wing camber again, maintaining her speed, but rising ever higher. She was tracking a straight line between the canyon and the summit, never deviating to either side. Grassy meadows with sturdy scrub bushes passed below her now, temperate lands, the plants lashed and cowed by the unremitting storms, but always flourishing. The twin cataracts of erupting water from the canyon were 15 kilometers behind her, and the clouds were parting, peeling off right and left, to find their own route around the volcano. Justine sought another path through the clear, sunny sky ahead and above. Her speed was still colossal, sufficient to carry her well cleared of the storm, but not quite enough for her ultimate goal. She began scanning the weather radar. As if the volcano's western midsection didn't have enough to contend with, twisters were skittering over the rumpled slopes, a legacy of clear air turbulence from the storm. She could see them through the canopy, spindly strands of beige ephemera, whipping violently back and forth across the land. They came in all sizes, from mild spirals of dust to brutal, dense vortices reaching kilometers in height. The onboard array plotted their courses, eliminating those too weak or too distant for her purpose. Not that any of them were truly predictable. This was where human intuition came in, and luck. There was one, 20 kilometers ahead, and slightly more southward than she would have preferred, but it stood nearly 5 kilometers high, siphoning up car-sized boulders as it wove its erratic course. Justine banked around, lining the hyperglider's nose on it. She acquired yet more speed as the craft sank closer to the ground. The wings and vertical stabilizer shrank inward, thickening as they went. Her eyes were mesmerized by the wild pirouettes of the twister's base, leaving her hungry for a pattern, any sort of clue to which way it would swerve next. The hyperglider's descent became a fearsome dive. She swayed it in time with the base of the twister, judging, anticipating. Wings and stabilizer were down to nothing more than stubs, giving her minimal control. The ground was barely 500 meters away. Ahead of her, the twister altered course again. She knew it would hold steady for perhaps a couple of seconds, and pushed the joystick forward, arrowing the craft straight at it. At the last moment she pulled up, watching the nose trace a sharp curve. The horizon fell away, leaving her with a sky that faded from glaring turquoise to fabulous deep indigo. Then the hyperglider penetrated the twister. Enraged dust and whirling grit surrounded the fuselage, holding it tight. The wings and rear stabilizers bowed around, forming a stumpy propeller as the nose finished its arc to point straight up along the wavering, unstable core of whirling air. Wing blades bit deep, spinning the fuselage and thrusting it up in one potent motion. Particles from sand, up to alarmingly large stones, hammered away on the fuselage. The multiple impacts sounded as if she were being hit by machine gun fire. Structural stress levels quickly went to their amber alert levels. She flinched almost continually from the stones smacking against the cockpit transparency, not a foot from her face. Despite that, this was the moment, the reason she was here. Not everybody got to this point. Some were smeared along the floor and walls of Stakeout Canyon. Others who'd actually managed to fly up the waterfall never found a twister, or messed up the entry. But her foreign memories had played true, giving her the skill. All she had to provide was the determination to back it up. That was what she'd come to this place for, finding out if she was still the same impetuous, carefree person she remembered from her first life. Motors whined loudly below her back, providing a counterspin to the forward fuselage. It helped enormously with stability, as well as holding the cockpit steady. That was the theory, anyway. She still felt dizzy and queasy, not that there was any visual reference to check if she was spinning. Virtual vision graphics showed a modest rotation that the onboard array was trying to compensate for. Acceleration was pushing her painfully deep into the seat. It was only moments later when the hyperglider shot out of the top of the twister like a missile from its launch tube. Even though she'd only been inside for a few moments, her velocity had almost doubled. Fuselage motors strained again, halting the counter-rotation. The hyperglider's wings and rear stabilizer lengthened, this time taking on a more normal planform. Straight, narrow wings and a cruciform tail. There was very little atmosphere to affect them now, The hyperglider was sliding quickly and smoothly through the stratosphere. However, she did angle them so the trajectory bent slightly. The craft was chasing a simple ballistic curve, the apex of which would be 9 kilometers above Mount Herculaneum's summit. She watched the pressure display digits wind down until it was registering an effective vacuum outside the fuselage. The sky had changed from blue to midnight black. Stars shone strongly all around, while dazzlingly bright sunlight poured into the cockpit. The contrast was astounding, from the pummeling terror of the storm to the utter silent serenity of space in a few seconds. Even though this environment was every bit as lethal to a human as the storm, she felt strangely secure up here. Her yammering heart began to subside. She eased the seat straps away from her shoulders and craned to get a good look outside. She was almost level with the summit of Mount Herculaneum and still rising. The volcano spread out below her, its lower slopes lost below the clouds. Far behind the hyperglider's tail, the storm emerged from Stakeout Canyon to boil away furiously around the immense rock barrier. Twisting her head to starboard, she could look down into Mount Titan's crater. Right at the bottom of it was a demonic scarlet glow from the lava lake, partially obscured by webs of thick black smoke. Broad tendrils waved upward, thinning out as they reached the lip to disperse into a haze that drizzled flaky gray ash across the upper slopes. She was mildly disappointed it wasn't in full eruption. Locals working as crews for the caravan had enthused about Mount Doom, as they called it, only half-jokingly, in full flow. 8.5 kilometers above the summit of Mount Herculaneum, the hyperglider had reached the top of its arc. Its trajectory was flattening out as Faraway's low gravity slowly began to reassert itself. The planet's horizon rose into view beyond the nose, a crisp white curve against the black of space. Directly below her were the twin caldera, two vast indentations in a drab russet plain of solidified lava waves and broken clinker. Justine's radio picked up a few scattered words, heavy with blasts of static from the expeditions trekking over the airless surface. Hiking trips to the top of Herculaneum were another of Faraway's principal tourist attractions. It wasn't difficult. The slopes weren't particularly steep, and the low gravity gave off-world visitors an easy time of it. But the last half had to be covered in pressure suits. And the only real view, sensational though it was, came from Aphrodite's Seat, the clifftops just below the Caldera Plateau. Anyone wanting to walk to the actual highest point, an unimpressive mound on the wall of the northern crater, faced a long, dreary slog across a lunar-style landscape to reach it. With the hyperglider's nose now dipping slightly, Faraway filled most of the universe to the east of the volcano. From her supreme vantage point, Justine could see the Dassault Mountain stretching away ahead and southward. Small, sharp pinnacles stabbed up through the gentle whirl of clouds. They guarded the high desert south of the equator, a cold land almost devoid of cloud. Over to the east, she could see a smear of deep greens, where the steppes began their long roll toward the North Sea and Armstrong City. The horizon's pronounced curve presented the illusion that she was seeing an entire hemisphere of the planet, like some ancient god of myth gazing down on Earth. Although Faraway lacked the softer textures granted to the old gods of Mount Olympus. The white clouds covered a graded spectrum of miserable browns and greys. Despite close to 2 centuries of human endeavor, the planet's land surface was nowhere near recovered from the mammoth and utterly lethal solar flare that had called people here. Tough, independent-minded settlers had pushed out from Armstrong City, planting their seeds and spraying energetic, wholesome soil bacteria across the empty miles of dusty sand. But the biosphere remained tenuous, its progress toward full planetary enrichment slow. So much was still desert or blasted earth. Very, very little of the planet's original flora and fauna had survived the radiation. The greenery she could see was alien to this place, invaders colonizing a near-dead world. She soared silently and smoothly over the towering cliffs of Aphrodite's Seat that guarded the eastern approach to Herculaneum's summit. Many kilometers below them was the glacier ring that encircled the entire volcano, extending hundreds of meters across the bare rock. Sunlight glinted from the gritty, fractured ice, producing a halo-like aura at the upper limit of the atmosphere. Sheltering beneath the glare were the alpine forests, gene-modified earth pines that had been introduced here as a beacon of life and color that could be seen for hundreds of kilometers. She smiled down on them, as she would any old friend, grateful for the comfort of familiarity that they brought. Ghostly waves of blue and green began to shimmer across the weather radar screen as the hyperglider sank back into the upper atmosphere, showing her the pressure building outside the fuselage. Justine extended the wings again, shaping them into a broad delta. After a while, the cockpit began to tremble as the leading edges bit deeper and deeper into the air. Aerodynamic forces started to take over from the ballistic impetus. Justine slowly shook off the dreamy lethargy that had captured her during the flight over the volcano. Practical decisions had to be made. From this altitude, she could easily coast along for 400 or 500 kilometers, putting her well clear of the volcano. But ahead, that would put her into the Dassault Mountains, while north and south would take her back into the divided wings of the storm. There was also distance to consider. The farther she flew now, the longer it would take the caravan to recover her. She altered the hyperglider's pitch, putting the nose up so the air would start to break her speed. Her rate of descent increased, which she balanced against the slope below, maintaining the same height above the ground. Clouds flashed around her, ablaze with bright monochrome light, as she passed through the level of the glacier ring. When the hyperglider fell out of their base, she was above the pine forests. She could see grasslands stretching out beyond them, easy enough to land on, but they were still high. It would be cold. The grasslands grew more lush and verdant as she flew on. Swirls of wind from the lower slopes began to affect the hyperglider, shaking it with growing strength. Bushes and trees speckled the grasses, building swiftly to a dense tropical rainforest that formed an unbroken skirt around the eastern base of the volcano. Looking down, she could see the small black dots of birds flitting amid the treetops. She was already 800 kilometers from where she'd started, and that was in a direct line. The caravan would have to go all the way around Mount Zeus before it even reached Herculaneum. Justine sighed and pushed the hyperglider down toward the rainforest canopy. This close, it wasn't as dense as she'd thought. There were clear swaths, shallow valleys with fast, silver streams that had hardly any trees at all, lines of dangerous crags. Several times she saw animals racing across open spaces. The Commonwealth Council's biosphere revitalization project had certainly been successful here. The radar switched to ground mapping mode. Justine was searching for a reasonable patch of ground to land on. Although, in extremis, the hyperglider could come down in a patch barely 100 meters long, she didn't fancy trying that. Fortunately, the scans revealed a straightish stretch, 3 kilometers ahead and to the north. She brought the hyperglider's nose around, lining it up. The clear ground was easily visible amid the trees. It looked like there was a clump of rock a third of the way along, nothing too serious. When she switched the radar to a higher resolution, it showed a narrow, shallow gully running across one end of the clear ground. She started her pre-landing flare, shrinking the wings in again, enhancing the camber. The edge of the long clearing rushed toward her. Three of her console display screens distorted into a hash of random color. Shit! Her e-butler was slow to respond, reporting several processors dropping out of the onboard array. Even her inserts were degraded. What's happening? She demanded. Her virtual hands flickered and vanished. A gust of wind slewed the hyperglider to starboard. She groaned in dismay as the cockpit tilted. The console screen displays were making no sense. Multiple electronic system failure, the e-butler said, compensating to restore core function. Hands wavered back into her virtual vision. You have control. Justine automatically countered the dangerous roll with a simple wing twist. The little craft responded sluggishly, forcing her to accentuate the maneuver. When she glanced up from the console, she cursed. She was already over the clear ground and losing altitude fast. All her display screens had righted themselves. Control surface responses were instantaneous again. She initiated the landing sequence. The wings rotated through almost 90 degrees, breaking the last of the hyperglider's speed. It began to sink as if it were made from lead. 20 meters from the ground, and with almost no forward motion at all, she altered the wings again. They shot out into huge, thin, concave triangles, generating as much lift as possible from her stall speed. The landing strut wheels touched and rebounded. Then she was bouncing over the rough terrain for 40 meters before the wheels finally halted. The wings and stabilizer shrank back into their buds. Justine let out a huge breath of relief. The cockpit canopy hissed as the seal disengaged, and it hinged upward. Plyplastic flowed away from her hands, and she let go of the grip bars. She released her helmet catches and took it off. A somewhat nervous laugh escaped her lips as she shook her sweaty hair out. All the hyperglider's electronic systems were back online. The craft had come to rest on a slight incline in grass and some purple leaf plants that were long enough to brush the bottom of the fuselage. A stream burbled away, 20 meters to her left. Hot, humid air was already making her perspire. Birds were crying overhead. The surrounding wall of the rainforest was draped in thick ropes of vine that were sprouting a million tiny lavender flowers. Justine clambered over the side of the cockpit and dropped to the ground in an easy, low-gravity curve. Only then did the enormity of what she'd done hit her. Both legs gave way, and she fell to her knees. Tears blinded her eyes, and she was laughing and crying at the same time, while her shoulders shook uncontrollably.
"Oh, Jesus Christ! I did it!"
she said, sobbing.
"I did it! I did it! I goddamn did it!"
The laughter was turning hysterical. She gripped some of the grass strands and made an attempt to calm herself. It had been a long time since she had given in to raw emotion like this, a sure sign of youthfulness. Her breathing steadied, and she wiped the back of her hand across her eyes, smudging away the tears. She climbed to her feet, careful not to make sudden moves. In this gravity, her inertia played havoc with all normal motions. A few birds were flapping about overhead, but that was about the only motion. The sun shone down, making her squint. Its heat made the skin on her face tingle. And the humidity. She puffed out a breath and began to struggle her way out of the leathery flight suit. Her e-butler triggered the hyperglider's locator. A small section of the fuselage behind the open cockpit irised open, and shiny folds of balloon fabric slithered out. It inflated quickly and rose up into the bright sapphire sky, trailing a thin carbon wire aerial behind it. Justine checked that the transmitter was working as she slathered on sun cream. She kept her boots on, but hurriedly discarded the flight suit in favour of simple white shorts with matching t-shirt. Everyone on the convoy swore there were no dangerous animals around, certainly not on the Grand Triad, and the Barsoomians, with their weird creatures, were thousands of kilometers away on the other side of the Oak Sea. So she should be all right, dressed like this. She slipped her multifunction wrist array on, a bronze malmetal bracelet with emeralds set along the rim, a gift from her last husband. He'd laughed about her using its extensive capabilities to survive the department store sales. That deteriorating sense of humor of his had hurried their divorce forward by several years. The bracelet contracted softly, connecting its eye spot to her Ock tattoo. Her e-butler expanded out from her inserts into the larger array, increasing its capacity by an order of magnitude. She ordered it to open the hyperglider's cargo compartment underneath the cockpit and check through her equipment and supplies. It would probably take the recovery vehicles 3 days or so to reach her. She had decent food for a week, and dehydrated rations for another 30 days, although she really hoped she wouldn't have to eat any of it. Right at the front of the compartment was a box from the tour company, with a chilled bottle of champagne in a thermal jacket and a box of chocolates. She was tempted, but the first thing she fished out of her personal case were her sunglasses, an expensive steel designer band that fitted snugly around her face, adjusting themselves to her skin. A floppy old bushman hat followed. She'd picked it up in Australia decades ago. The stupid cheap thing had been to more planets than most people, and was now bleached almost white by all those different suns. Okay, so what happened to the electronics?
she asked the e-butler as she took the wrapping off the chocolates. They'd started to melt in the heat. The cause of the system's failure is unknown. The onboard array lacks the diagnostic facilities to make a detailed analysis. There must be some indication. It would appear to be an external event. The recorded effect was similar to an EM pulse. Justine glanced around in shock, a chocolate strawberry half eaten. Someone was shooting at me? That is unknown. Could it have been a natural phenomenon? That is unknown. But it is possible. This array does not have any data on possible natural causes. Can you sense any EM activity? No. Justine gave the trees surrounding the open space a more careful look. She wasn't frightened, more like irritated. She simply wasn't used to not getting a definitive answer from her e-butler, when all of human knowledge was available in real time anywhere within the Commonwealth. But here, cut off from the Unisphere, data was a rarer, more precious commodity. And being shot at was a possibility, albeit remote. Firstly, there were the Guardians of Selfhood, who roamed the planet at will. As everyone knew, they were well-armed and prone to violence. Then there were other people, locals, who could make a great deal of money out of recovering a dead pilot's memory cell insert. Families would pay a big finder's fee to ensure their lost loved one's conscious continuity when growing a real-life clone. Hypergliding was uniquely dangerous. Dozens of pilots were killed each year. Most were recovered by the tour operator, and their memory cells returned home. But any whose flight was flung dramatically off course before crashing risked being lost for a very long time. Locals who came across the crash site were in for a bountiful time once they'd finished the gruesome task of cutting the memory cell free of the corpse. So it certainly wasn't beyond possibility that there were groups who facilitated a few crashes. If the EM pulse truly had been an attempt to crash her, they were piss poor at their job, she thought. Right at the back of the cargo compartment was a small ion pistol for her personal safety, should the landing site prove hostile. Nobody in the caravan had ever really defined hostile for her, the unspoken implication being wild animals. She gave the secure alcove a thoughtful look, then ordered the compartment to close and lock. If it was a criminal gang hunting her, she wouldn't stand a chance, armed or not. Time to find out, Justine told the hyperglider. Her voice sounded very loud in the long, tranquil clearing. She filled her water bottle from the stream, the semi-organic top sucking up the slightly muddy liquid, immediately filtering and cooling it. Then she set off into the trees, using the wrist array's inertial guidance function. It took her quite a while to backtrack the 1,000 or so meters where she'd roughly estimated the interference came from. The undergrowth could be vigorous in places, and where it was low, the vines and creepers filled the gaps between tree trunks. Her whole route seemed to be one giant detour. There was certainly no sign of any track, animal or human. Nor could she hear any voices. As she approached the general area, she began to feel sheepish. She jumped to a lot of conclusions very quickly. Pirates and conspiracies just seemed to fill her adrenaline-pumped mood. Now she was back to mundane reality. Hot, sweaty, having to swat creeper leaves out of her face the whole time, boots sinking into the damp, peaty soil. The one blessing of tramping through this jungle was the lack of insects, at least any of the varieties that feasted on humans. The revitalization team hadn't introduced any, though there were plenty of tiny multi-egged beetles roving around her feet, a great many of which looked alien to her. A lot of the plant species were certainly non-terrestrial. After about 20 minutes, Justine simply stopped. She was feeling ridiculous now. There was no sign of any human activity, and if there was a band of hunter pirates creeping down to the landing site through the trees, they were crap at tracking her when she was walking straight at them. "Can you sense anything?" she asked her e-butler. "This unit's sensors are registering some weak electromagnetic activity," it replied. "It is difficult to locate an origin point. It appears to be operating on a regular cycle." "Some kind of radio signal?" "No, it is a multiband emission. There is no identifiable modulation." "A power burst, then?" "That is a source which would fit the sensor data."
"What kind of equipment would generate that?"
"That is unknown."
"Okay,
Which direction is it coming from? Give me a graphic. The e-butler expanded a simple map into her virtual vision. Justine started walking, pushing the vines apart. The emission just repeated, her e-butler said after she'd gone about 50 meters. It was much stronger. The sensors are registering a degree of residual activity. There is no pattern to it. Am I still going in the right direction?
Yes.
What about the pulse duration? Does that correspond to the one which hit the hyperglider?
It is very close.
The trees seemed to be spaced slightly farther apart, although that could have been her imagination. The undergrowth and vines certainly didn't slacken off. She'd gotten long scratches on her legs. The overlaid map faded from her sight. What's happening? There was no reply from her e-butler. She halted and looked at her bracelet. The little power light behind one of the emeralds was winking red.
Reboot complete,
her e-butler announced abruptly. Did the pulse hit you?
No data from the event was retained. Another pulse is the most obvious explanation.
Can you safeguard against another one? Silence answered her.
Damn it,
she muttered, but she was intrigued now. Something was close by, and it wasn't pirates. She almost missed it. The vines had completely swamped the low walls, making the small building look like nothing more than another impenetrable cluster of greenery. But the door had sagged inward, leaving a dark cleft amid the leaves. Justine pushed up her sunglasses to study the structure for a moment. It certainly wasn't a house. It was too small for that. Just a simple square shelter 5 meters to a side, with a sloping roof no more than 3 meters high at the apex. When she pulled the thick cords of creeper from the wall around the door, she found the surface beneath was made of some dull gray composite, simple panels bolted onto a metal frame, put together in a few hours. It could have been made anywhere in the Commonwealth. Even far away had the resources to produce this. By the look of the material and the vegetation clinging to it, the shelter had been here for decades. There was no lock, so she put her shoulder to the warped door and shoved. It flew open after a few pushes. Light streamed in through the opening. There were no windows. The floor was a single sheet of enzyme-bonded concrete, wet and crumbling. In the middle was a black cylinder, just over a meter in diameter and 80 centimeters high. When she went over to it, she saw it was actually embedded in the concrete, so she had no idea of its true length. It seemed to be made from a dark metal. Two sets of thin red cable emerged from the top and ran across the floor to disappear into a translucent disc half a meter wide. Examining that, she found the disc was also set into the concrete. It glowed with a faint vermilion light that originated deep inside, seemingly well below the concrete floor. Justine narrowed her eyes at the disc as memories began to stir. She wasn't even sure why she'd kept such old times in her head when she rejuvenated. But she'd seen something like this before. A lot of buildings on Earth used them as a power backup. Places like hospitals and police and transport control centers. A solid-state heat exchange cable sunk kilometers down into the crust, where the geothermal energy could be tapped. They didn't generate a huge amount of electricity, just enough to keep essential systems functioning in case of emergency. So what the hell is one doing in the middle of a jungle, halfway up the biggest volcano on far away? She stared at the cables, which were presumably superconductors. The cylinder they were feeding power into must be the source of the EM pulses. And the whole arrangement had obviously been here for a long time, at least a couple of decades, and probably a lot longer than that. Certainly nobody had visited for ages, and concrete didn't crumble overnight. So what could possibly use or absorb that much electricity year after year? Her puzzlement was pushed aside by surprise, as she realized the only thing the cylinder could be, a Niling desink. They were the ultimate storage devices, and as such were rarely used within the Commonwealth, simply because few people needed to store that much power. CST used them as backup supplies for their wormhole gateways, but she couldn't remember any other organization, commercial or government, having a use for them. They were a quirk of physics, a zero-size sinkhole in space-time that you could keep filling with energy.
Theoretically, any power level could be contained, providing the confining quantum field was strong enough. And after uninterrupted decades of charging from the heat exchange cables, this one would have an accumulated power level that wasn't so much measured in kilowatt hours, more like kilotonnage. So, annihilating desync that pushed out an EM pulse. Unshielded. Justine got out of the shelter quickly. If it truly was unshielded, the electromagnetic emission would be intense enough to harm her nervous system as the quantum field cycled ready to admit its next input charge. She hurried away, even more confused now she'd found the source. It began to rain before she got 100 meters. The storm that had split to curve around the volcano had finally caught up with her. Casimir McFoster watched the girl pull a fist-sized ball of shiny blue plastic out of the compartment that had opened under the hyperglider's cockpit. He was sheltering behind a ficus bush, 50 meters away from where the sleek machine had landed. Rain pattered away on his head and the long dark crimson leaves alike. He paid it no heed. This was the weather he had grown up with. Always at this time of year, the storms would come in the morning. In another hour or so, the rain clouds would have blown away to the east, leaving the rest of the day mercilessly hot and humid. The girl casually threw the ball over her shoulder, then tugged a big cylindrical bag from the compartment. He was impressed, for the bag was large and obviously heavy. But despite the clumsy way she carried it, she could lift it easily. She was strong. All off-worlders were strong, he knew that. What he hadn't expected was her beauty. He had seen the glider pass overhead an hour earlier, a simple cruciform shape, black against the glaring sapphire sky. The sight had enthralled him, it was so graceful, so elegant. All the stories and learning of the Commonwealth and its ways had never prepared him for this, that a machine could be so poised, not just in shape, but in function, was a revelation. Machines, as Casimir knew them, were blunt and functional. From his vantage point atop a lava outcrop, he'd watched as it swooped ever lower over the jungle. Only once did it wobble in an ungainly fashion, and that was only for an instant. Then its wings had moved like those of a nimble bird as it alighted in the open space. Casimir had stood looking at the place where it had sunk from sight behind the trees, a simpleton's smile on his face. It took him a while to realize he was exposed on the rock. Harvey would scold him relentlessly for such a lapse. There would probably be short rations as well to emphasize the point. He was supposed to be well past making such stupid mistakes. That was why he was out here alone in this, his final ground walk, to prove he had mastered the wild. After he returned alive to the clan in another 15 days, he would be ready to join battle against the alien monster. But not if he stood around like a first-year novice, offering himself as an easy target for any enemy who might be passing. Casimir dropped down off the rock and back into the undergrowth. He thought for a moment, placing the glider's position in his mind. Then he was ready to pathfind through the trees, alert for enemies, focused on his goal. By the time he'd stealthily crept up to the fringes of the lengthy clearing where the glider had landed, it was raining heavily. He couldn't see anyone, so he'd found himself a safe place of concealment and settled down to observe the sleek craft. The girl had appeared a couple of minutes later, her face screwed up against the rain as she hurried out of the trees. She was all in white, a few scraps of cloth clinging to her slender frame. And she was so beautiful, like an angel, Casimir thought. An angel come down from the sky. The blue ball that the girl had discarded on the ground began to swell, with folds of thin plastic bulging out in odd shapes. The whole mass rolled around as if it were a living creature in pain. A minute later, it had become a bulbous hemispherical shelter 4 meters across at the base, with a single opening, like a bloated tent. Casimir nodded in appreciation. His own night shelter was a little sack of shape-shift membrane that he could inflate with a small electric current. It kept him warm and dry at night, but it wasn't big enough to move around in. This was a palace in comparison. The girl hurried inside. Casimir saw her grimace as she pulled a shabby, soaking wet hat from her head and ran her hands back through equally wet, white blonde hair. She delved into her cylindrical bag and produced a towel, which she rubbed vigorously over herself. Every movement fascinated Casimir. She had long limbs, all of them perfectly shaped. The way she held her head, proud but never arrogant. Not her, not the angel. She eventually finished with the towel and went over to the fat tent's opening to peer out. Casimir held his breath as she looked at the thick bush sheltering him. She smiled coyly, and the universe was a happier place because of it. For a second. "It must be uncomfortable crouching behind that bush," she called. "Why don't you come out into the open?" Casimir's heart thudded loudly. She must be talking to him. She must have known he was there all along. He fumed, angry that his lack of skill had been mocked so. Yet the angel was still looking at him, head cocked to one side, an expectant expression in place. There actually wasn't any mockery, he decided. He rose to his feet and looked from side to side, half expecting the enemy's hunters to be there, waiting and grinning. But there was only the rain. So Casimir had a simple choice: turn and leave, and never see her beauty again, or walk over and let her see him, which apparently she could anyway. He walked toward the blue hemisphere, still wary. The angel's head was cocked slightly to one side, regarding him with a guarded expression. One of her hands was holding a slim cylinder that he knew had to be some kind of weapon. "You don't have any friends nearby, do you?" she asked. "I walk this forest alone. I need no help to survive here." She seemed amused by this. "Of course." The weapon was pushed discreetly into a pouch on her belt. "Would you like to come in out of the rain? There's plenty of room in here." "You are most kind. I thank you." When he ducked inside, he was suddenly, unaccountably overwhelmed by her presence. His eyes sought out the smooth features of the interior, looking everywhere but at her. "My name's Justine," she said gently. There was a hesitancy in her voice, as if she was as uncertain as he. "Casimir," he said, "how did you know I was there?" A slim arm was raised, a finger tapping just below her right eye. "My inserts have an infrared capability. You were shining quite brightly." Her lips twitched. "Your heart, you know." "Oh." But he'd foolishly followed the motion of her hand and now couldn't look away from her face. Her eyes were light green, he saw, with slim eyebrows. She had long, prominent cheekbones and a somewhat flattish jaw. A slender button nose poised above wide, moist lips. Every feature was delicate, yet together they awarded her a sophistication he was sure he could never match. And her flawless skin was a shade of pale honey gold he'd never known before. In surprise, he realized she was very young, close to his own 17 years. Yet she had flown the glider through the heart of the storm. The courage and talent, that must take. He looked at his feet again, aware of distance opening between them. "Here you go," she said kindly, and handed him the towel she was holding. "You're actually wetter than I am." Casimir looked at it in confusion for a moment, before slipping his small backpack off. "Thank you." He mopped the moisture off his face, then shrugged out of his leather waistcoat. The towel's thin fabric seemed to suck the droplets off his chest and back as he rubbed, leaving his skin perfectly dry. Justine reached into her bag and produced another towel for herself. He was aware of her eyes on him, narrowed with amusement, as he dried his shins and calves. So he stopped at his knees, not lifting his kilt to dry his thighs, though they weren't that damp. The kilt was reasonably waterproof. "What tartan is that?" she asked. He glanced down at the emerald and copper check and smiled with pride. "I am a McFoster." Justine produced a sound that sounded suspiciously like a snort. "I'm sorry," she said contritely. "But with that skin color, it's a little difficult to picture you as a native clansman." Casimir frowned. His skin was a rich brown, complemented by thick jet hair that he wore long and tied back with a single scarlet band. How could colors prevent him from being a clan member? Between them, the clans had members from most of Old Earth's racial groups. His grandmother always told wonderful tales of her grandmother's early life in India. "I don't understand. My ancestors were one of the first families to be saved by Bradley Johansson." "Johansson?"
We're not talking Scottish clans here, are we?
What's, Scottish?
Never mind. She looked out of the entrance at the steady downpour of warm rain. It looks like we've got a bit of time to spend together. Tell me about your clan, Casimir.
The rains will only last another hour.
How long a story is it? He grinned at her, warmed by her answering smile. The angel was so achingly beautiful, any excuse to remain close to her was welcome. As if knowing this, the wall of the tent beside him changed shape and expanded out to form a couch. They sat on it together.
Tell me, she urged. I want to know about your world.
Will you tell me of your flight?
I will.
He nodded his head, happy at the promised trade. There are 7 clans living on far away. Together we form the Guardians of Selfhood.
I've heard of them, she murmured.
We stand between the Starflyer alien and human ruin. Alone of all our race, we see the danger it brought with its shadows of deceit and its manipulation of vain men and women. Bradley Johansson opened our eyes to the truth long ago. One day, thanks to him, we will help this planet take its revenge.
That sounds like something you've been taught, Casimir.
Since the moment I drew my first breath, I have known what I am and what I must face.
Ours is a harsh burden. None of you off-worlders believe in our cause. You are blind to the alien's poison.
Yet we endure because of our faith and our gratitude. Bradley Johansson is our savior, and one day all of humanity will know him as their savior.
How did he save you?
As he was saved, by decency and kindness. He came to this world among the first people and began to investigate the alien's ship.
I heard that, Justine said. He was the first director of the Marie Celeste Research Institute, wasn't he?
Yes. People say it is deserted, a wreck, abandoned and empty.
It is not.
That is what the alien would have humanity believe.
It survived the crash.
There's a living alien here, from the Ark ship. It used to be here. It passed into the Commonwealth long ago, where it moves among us, hidden and evil.
Really? So you've never seen it for yourself, then?
I have never left far away. But one day the Starflyer will return when its schemes reach fruition. I hope that is within my lifetime. I would like to be a part of its downfall.
What does it look like?
Nobody knows what it looks like. Not even Bradley Johansson is sure. He may have seen it, he can't remember. Many of his old thoughts were lost when he was liberated.
Okay, so this Starflyer survived the crash. What happened then?
It ignited the flare in faraway sun to lure the unsuspecting here. And when Bradley Johansson delved into the secrets of the ship, he awoke the Starflyer and was enslaved by it. For many years he toiled under its control, helping to extend its influence into the Commonwealth, whispering into the hearts of those in power, issuing false promises and shaping the tide of events. But the Starflyer was ignorant of this part of the galaxy, and troubled by the other races who live here, fearful they would thwart its goals. Not all of them are as ignorant and prideful as us. It sent Bradley to Silvergalda, so that he could experience the Sylphon firsthand and report back on what he found. But the Sylphon are wiser than humans, and the Starflyer. They could see the bonds which it had cast into Bradley's mind, and cut him free.
Ah, the liberation.
Yes, they cured him. Some men, having been freed, would run away from such a horror so they could remain free, but Bradley knew there was a greater danger in that. He said that for wickedness to succeed, all it takes is for decent people to do nothing.
Bradley Johansson said that, did he?
Yes. He returned to Faraway and liberated others who had been enslaved by the Starflyer. They were the 7 families who grew into the clans.
I see.
Her voice was serious. Casimir glanced anxiously at her. The expression on her face was terribly sober. It saddened him that lovely face should only know happiness. Wasn't protecting her and her kind what he had given his life to?
Don't worry, he told her.
We will guard you from the Starflyer. It will not succeed.
This planet will be revenged.
Her head tipped to one side as she gave him a long, thoughtful gaze. You really mean that, don't you?
Yes.
For some reason, the answer seemed to trouble her.
It's a very noble thing that you do, Casimir. Nobility exerts a kinship which is hard to break. The Starflyer will never corrupt my loyalty to my clan and our cause. Justine laid a hand on his arm. I respect that. Casimir tried to smile confidently at her, but she still seemed sad, and her touch, light though it was, distracted him terribly. She was so very close, and neither of them was wearing much clothing. Lustful, yet wondrous thoughts began to percolate through Casimir's mind. Justine gave his arm a quick little squeeze, and suddenly looked around. Oh, look! It stopped raining. She sat up and went over to the entrance. The sun's out again. Her smile was lovely. She was the angel again. Casimir got to his feet and took a moment to put his waistcoat back on. He went outside and stood behind her as she slipped a steel band around her face. It disappointed him that he could no longer see her eyes. The sunlight made her white T-shirt nearly transparent. She was as tall as he. Did you really fly over the volcano? He asked hurriedly. Uh-huh. That must take so much courage. She laughed. Just stupidity, I think. No, you are not stupid, Justine. Never that. A finger hooked over the top of her sunglasses, and she pulled them down a fraction to stare at him over the rim. Thank you, Casimir. That's very sweet. What was it like? Crazy. Wonderful. She popped her sunglasses back up and started telling him about the flight. Casimir listened, fascinated by a world and life as alien to his as that of the Starflyer. Justine possessed a perfect existence. It gladdened him to know that such a life was real, that humans could reach such a state. One day, perhaps, when the Starflyer was vanquished, all of them would live as she did. It must be fate, he decided, that he'd met her. This vision, his own personal angel, come to show him that he was right to try to protect human life. She was his inspiration, his private miracle. You must be very rich, he said when she finished telling him about the landing, to afford such a craft that has no purpose other than to bring you enjoyment. She shrugged casually. They were both lounging on the bank above the little stream that gurgled its way along the clearing. Everybody who visits far away is rich, I guess. It's not easy to get here. She tipped her head back to admire the tufty clouds drifting across the sapphire basin of the sky. But definitely worthwhile. You have a strange and lovely world, Casimir. What do your parents think of you coming here by yourself and taking such risks? That flight was very dangerous. Her head came around quickly, as if she'd been shocked by the question. My parents? Ah, well, let's see. My parents always encouraged me to be myself. They wanted me to live my life as best I can. And this, Mount Herculaneum, you, this has to be one of those classic moments that make life worthwhile and give you the confidence to go on and just experience what the universe has to offer. Me? I think not. Yes, you. Here you are on your own adventure, all by yourself, facing whatever the volcano and the land throw at you. That makes you a lot braver than me. No. Yes. No. They both laughed. Justine took her sunglasses off and smiled warmly at him. I'm starving, she said. Fancy trying some decadent earth food? Yes, please. She sprang up and raced toward the glider. Casimir hurried after her, awed by how high her perfect, slender body floated above the ground as she ran. They sat cross-legged on the ground, and she fed him morsels of food, eager for his reactions. Some of it was delicious, most was simply strange, like the hot curried meats that burned his mouth as he swallowed. Wash it down with this, she told him. The white wine she gave him was light and sweet. He sipped it appreciatively. In the afternoon they explored the jungle around the edge of the clearing, trying to guess the names of the plants. He explained the purpose behind his ground walk, how it prepared him for difficult campaigns against the enemy over all sorts of terrain, how it showed he had learned all his teachers could give him. A rite of passage, she said. He thought there was admiration in her voice, but then several times he'd seen her glancing at him when she thought he was unaware. He hadn't dared do the same. We must know that we can do what we have to do. Casimir, please, don't do anything rash. You never have to prove your worth by risking yourself. Life is too important for that. It's too short as well, especially here. I will be careful. I will learn not to be impetuous. Thank you. I don't want to spend my life worrying about you. Will you do something for me? Her smile was mischievous. There's a lot I'll do for you, Casimir. The answer surprised him. He knew he would be blushing as he attached his own interpretation to that. One he was sure she didn't intend, not someone so sweet and good-natured. Please don't visit the Marie Celeste. I know a lot of tourists do. I would worry for your safety if you did. The Starflyer's influence is strong around its ship. Justine made a show of pondering the request. Fortunately, the old Ark ship wasn't on the itinerary anyway. Strangely enough, because of Casimir's devout belief that there really was a surviving alien, a little frisson of worry crept into her head and refused to leave. The whole thing was one of those ridiculous legends used by wicked old men like Johansson to keep his followers in line and paying their dues. Yet at the same time, it sounded so plausible. I won't go, she promised solemnly. His look of relief made her feel guilty. They built a fire in the late afternoon. Casimir had an aging power blade in his pack and seemed intent on showing off his living-off-the-land survival skills to impress her. So she sat back and watched as he built a big pile of wood. He stripped off his little leather waistcoat, and the sweat showed on his skin from the effort of carrying the logs about. It was a sight that raised her own body temperature several degrees. Low gravity certainly hadn't stopped his bod from developing to late adolescent excellence. Thankfully, he didn't want to do anything macho like shoot birds out of the sky so they could roast them on a stick spit. He was quite content to open up more of her food packets. The bonfire was just for warmth and comfort. She finally popped the cork off the champagne, and they drank it with the leaping gold flames glimmering off its energetic bubbles. Casimir didn't want the evening to end. Not ever. They sat close on a blanket as the sunlight abandoned the sky. Then there was only a shimmering purple-edged nimbus high above the western horizon, as the glacier ring diffracted the last rays through the stratosphere. It shrank away, leaving the crackling bonfire as the only source of illumination. Platinum stars shone above them. For the first time in his life, he didn't think of them as a threat. They talked, and they drank, and they nibbled on the exotic food, and all the time Casimir silently worshipped the smiling, gorgeous angel with all his heart. A while after the sun had set, the bonfire's wild flames sank away to leave a mound of lambent coals. It was in that teasing radiance that the angel rose to her feet and stood over him. Her t-shirt and shorts gleamed magenta in the quiescent fire, while her hair had become the gold halo his mind had always perceived. Without a word, she walked over to her hemispherical tent, disappearing among the shadows that haunted the interior. Casimir. His limbs trembling, he went over to the entrance. Twinkling starlight showed him half of the floor had risen to become a giant mattress. His angel stood before it, a simple silhouette. Her t-shirt lay crumpled on the ground at her feet. As he watched, she slid the shorts down her legs. Don't be afraid. Casimir walked forward into the darkness. Gentle, sensual hands pushed the waistcoat from his shoulders. Unseen fingertips stroked his chest as they moved down to his waist, making him whimper helplessly. His belt was undone and his kilt removed. The naked angel was hot on his skin as she pressed herself up against him. Casimir's astonished cries of ecstasy rang out across the clearing, lasting long after the glittering sparks of the fire had finally died away. Not even the cabin's insulation could protect Estella Fenton from the roar of the powerful diesel engine. She held her highball glass up high as the suspension rocked the four-wheel drive Talmar Ranger from side to side, trying not to spill any of the elaborate fruit cocktail. It wasn't working, so she downed the rest of the drink in a couple of quick gulps. There was definitely vodka in it. She could feel the distinctive chill burning along her throat. The recovery vehicle sent out from the main convoy had picked her up 20 hours ago, which had come as a profound relief. 2.5 days alone in the temperate forest was slightly more wilderness adventure than she'd wanted. Now there was just her friend Justine to find. The convoy had picked up her hyperglider's beacon signal. Its location had caused a flutter of interest among the crews. Few people, apparently, managed to fly quite as far as Justine had. So once they'd loaded up Estella's hyperglider into its container trailer, the five remaining recovery vehicles had set off in search of their last client. For all that Faraway's population had left Mount Herculaneum as a natural wild park, there were plenty of paths through the rainforests of the lower slopes that vehicles like the Talmar used on tourist expeditions. Branching off them were tracks that were less well used, and then there were lines on the map that were marked as passable routes. They'd been on one of those for 3 hours solid, pushing their way through the vines and undergrowth of the jungle. Then came the really tough work of cutting a new route through the trees. The trailblazer vehicle was 50 yards ahead of them, its forward harmonic blade sending out dense clouds of fractured wood chips as it chewed its way ever onward. Watching its progress had sent Estella to the back of the cabin, where she started raiding the refrigerated bar. "Couple more minutes should do it," the driver, Cam Tong, called out. Estella put the empty glass down and peered through the bubble canopy at the broken swath of vegetation left behind by the trailblazer. The thick green walls of trees and vines came to an abrupt end, and they lurched out into a long clearing. Justine's hyperglider was intact, standing in the middle of a carpet of lush grass. Her tent was a few meters away. "Looks like she's okay," Cam Tong said happily. "I never doubted it." The recovery vehicles picked up speed, which increased the rocking motion. They all started sounding their horns. A head poked out of the tent. "That's not her," Estella exclaimed. It was a teenage boy, wearing Justine's tatty old bushranger hat. His mouth gaped wide at the big vehicles rushing toward him. Then he yelled something back into the tent. Next second, he'd snatched a small backpack off the ground and was sprinting toward the nearest tree line. Estella stared on in astonishment. He was wearing a long orange and green skirt. No, she corrected herself, a kilt. She could see the pleats. His small pack had a leather garment of some kind tied to it. He kept looking over his shoulder at the vehicles. One hand pressed the hat on his head, black hair streamed out from below the brim. Cam Tong was laughing as he braked the big Talmar behind the hyperglider. Estella's grin spread right across her mouth as she opened the door to climb down. Just then, Justine emerged from the tent. All she wore was a very small scarlet thong and a pair of sunglasses. "Come back!" Justine shouted above the blaring horns and yammering engines. "Don't be frightened! They're my friends! Oh, fuck it!" She put her hands on her hips and glared at the recovery vehicles. Estella dropped lightly to the ground. By now the grin had grown into near-hysterical laughter. Other vehicle doors were opening, the smiling crew clambering out. Horns were still being tooted enthusiastically. The frantic boy had almost reached the jungle. Whoops of encouragement were yelled after him. "Afternoon, darling," Estella called brightly. "You scared him off," Justine accused, her voice sounding hurt. Estella raised her hand to her throat in theatrical shock. "Why, thank heavens, we got here just in time by the look of it." She still couldn't stop laughing. "We obviously saved you from a fate worse than death." "God damn it!" Justine gave the fleeing boy a last look as he disappeared into the foliage. She raised her hand limply, hoping he would see her forlorn gesture. The horns fell silent as the engines were turned off, but the hearty laughter of the crew remained loud in the muggy air. Justine stomped back into the tent and picked up a light cardigan. Estella trailed after her. The floor mattress was still inflated. Empty food packets littered the ground around it, along with a couple of bottles of wine. "I don't believe your luck," Estella chortled. "I'm going to complain to the tour company. The only thing waiting for me at my landing site was a squirrel, and I'm pretty sure he was gay." Justine started buttoning up her cardigan. "Don't," she said irritably. "Casimir was sweet."
"Yeah, was."
"You don't understand." She pulled up her shorts. "It wasn't just that. I wanted to teach him a different view of the universe, make him question what he sees."
"Ah, like, what position is this called? And I didn't know you could do it that way around."
Justine growled at her and went back outside. She ordered the tent to contract, forcing Estella to hurry through the entrance. The crew were backing an empty trailer up to the hyperglider. Broad, knowing smiles were flashed in her direction. Several of them winked. Justine had to roll her eyes at that, thinking what it must have looked like to them. A small, sheepish smile appeared on her own lips as her sense of humor returned. "What was he doing here?" Estella asked. "This is nowhere." "It's somewhere now," Justine replied tartly. "God, your luck. I'm as jealous as hell." He looked divine. Justine pushed her lips together modestly.
"He was."
"Come on, let's go find a bottle. We should celebrate your grand victory. Longest flight and greatest landing. I expect you need to sit down, too. Must be difficult trying to walk properly after all that education you gave him." She glanced pointedly at the tent that had finished contracting. All the empty packets and bottles now lay around it, ejected by the shrinking walls. "Did you even get to see the outside world?"
"There is one."
Estella giggled wildly and started to climb up the short ladder to the Talmar's cabin.
"So, is it true? Does everything really rise higher in low gravity?"
Justine ignored her, scanning the jungle's dense wall one last time. There was no sign of him, not even using infrared. She'd taught him that, if nothing else.
"Goodbye, Casimir," she whispered.
He would be out there, watching, probably feeling a little foolish now, but this was probably the best way. A swift, clean break, and a golden memory for both of them. No regrets. And maybe, just maybe, I taught him something about real life. Maybe he will start to question his idiotic guardian's doctrine. There was a loud pop of a champagne cork in the cabin. Justine climbed inside and shut the door, enjoying the chill of the air conditioning as it banished the jungle's raw heat.